This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Anyone who enjoys trivia probably knows that Humphrey Bogart never actually says, "Play it again, Sam," in Casablanca. And Captain Kirk never once says, "Beam me up, Scotty," in Star Trek. But what about these quotes? Cleanliness is next to godliness. God works in mysterious ways. For years, many people have assumed these came from the Bible. Spoiler alert, they don't. Or at least they didn't.
The Bible is pretty hilarious anyway, but the things we think are in it often are not, so we thought we'd have a little fun with that.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about the lost book of Hezekiah that finally gives a home to those phantom biblical ditties. We'll also hear about some friends who met during Bible study and started a brewery, learn about a German who's helping migrants complete their education, and spend an academic minute with Planned Parenthood. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. You learn an awful lot while producing a public radio program. Here's what I learned this week. There are Bible nerds, and they have a pretty good sense of humor. There are a lot of things we say that we assume are in the Bible. Most aren't, until now. The new book Hezekiah is the brainchild of two seminarians who thought there should be a book in the Bible for all of these orphan expressions.
A reading, the book of Hezekiah, chapter 5. Show them, O Lord, that the devil sits on an idle horse, that their idle hands are his workshop. For I know everything happens for a reason. Spare not the rod in training us, O Lord. Spoil not your children when you bring us up in your way. Divert them, my king, from doctrines that seem to glitter but are not gold. Correct them when wolves in sheep's clothing tell them that the absence from your temple will make their hearts grow fonder of you.
That's Harry Hazel, one of the authors of the book. His co-author is Reverend Susan Presley, pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Mendota, Illinois. I spoke to Susan about the book and how it gives expressions like cleanliness is next to godliness a new home. Now, two things. I've known Susan for years, and I think she's two steps up from awesome. And for reasons beyond explaining, she calls Harry, her co-author, Max.
That's exactly the type of thing that we put in there because, it should be in there somewhere. So we wrote a book to include all these things.
Now tell us about Hezekiah. Who is he?
Hezekiah actually is a king that was mentioned in Scripture. He's mentioned in Isaiah, and he was a pretty good king, if not like just a little clueless. So sort of like how you think of Dan Quayle, maybe. Like he didn't mean any harm exactly, but occasionally he put his foot in his mouth. Maybe more Joe Biden, I don't know. But he was going along and everything was going good in his kingship, and he got sick, but he didn't die. And so the neighboring country sent a couple emissaries over and said, "Hey, good job not dying. We brought you some gifts from the other king." They may have been spies, they may not have been, we're not sure. But Hezekiah said, "Wow, thanks for the gifts. Want to see all my stuff? I'll show you where I store the gold and all our war stuff." Well, that wasn't very smart. So we thought Hezekiah was maybe just a little dim, would be a good way to put that. At the beginning of Hezekiah here, we mention his pedigree. He's the son of Amoz and other kings, and it goes on, you know. He has a heritage of kings. It's a hereditary issue, being the king.
What was it like trying to write in the biblical style? Is it something that came naturally because it's something you studied for so many years?
I grew up as a Baptist preacher's daughter. We spoke in these and thous around the house. But as luck would have it, Max, my co-author, is the one who did most of the actual scripture. And I did the wise guy notes, which reference where the quotes actually come from. So, spare the rod and spoil the child is one you mentioned. We have that in Hezekiah 5:10, and a person might wonder where that comes from. That one, oddly, sort of comes from the book of Proverbs, but it's been adapted over the years. So, if you read the notes that go with each expression, each saying, each adage, whatever you want to call it, there really is a reference for each of them. I'm more of a researcher, so I did that end of it.
Who are you aiming this book at? Who do you think wants to read this book?
We think Bible nerds, any sort of, there's a nerd for every group, but like there's sci-fi nerds, there's also Bible nerds. Anybody that just sort of enjoys a laugh and can take religion not too seriously. Max and I are friends that met in seminary, and after enough classwork, you get a little slap happy, and we did this over a summer break. So seminarians, ministers, anybody that's a fan of the Bible, or anybody that really wants to find out what's not in the Bible.
Is there an actual story to this?
Oh, it does flow like a story, yes. And around about chapter 8, it gets a little saucy. Maybe that's the reason not everybody's a fan. But it's it does flow as a story. As King Hezekiah wandered through his vineyards and his storehouses, we figure maybe that's about the time that, as the scripture says, that it all began to hit the fan and he hit the bottle. and so perhaps he was a little loopy when he wrote some of this, we figure.
I don't think anybody mistook hitting the fan for a biblical verse. I think that one you just made up.
We probably did. We were sober the entire time we wrote this, however.
I believe every word you're saying.
I'm ordained. You have to.
Okay. And is this actually broken up into chapter and verse?
It is. It's broken up into chapter and verse and sort of situated like scripture there on the page.
Being an actual real-life reverend, did you expect any blowback from this?
Of course. The church where I am, I've only been here 3 months, and I did warn them about this book before they hired me. So, but they are a church with good humor, so it's worked out pretty well. It's an 8-chapter book, and then there's, you know, the glossary and the notes and that sort of thing. There was one minister who we asked to write a back-of-the-book blurb for us, and he wrote, "I don't always preach from fake scripture, but when I do, it's from Hezekiah."
Nice.
So I think there may be a minister already doing that.
He's the most interesting minister in the world.
I'll leave him nameless.
Okay, very nicely done. So what kind of reaction are you getting from, you know, nerds and non-nerds alike?
So far, the reviews have been good, very good on Amazon. One person gave it quite the tongue-in-cheek review with only 4 stars out of 5. Because they thought we could have dug deeper into Hezekian scholarship, which is a total made-up word, but we appreciated their humor. We did have one person that was unhappy and got a refund on the book, but otherwise it's been good.
When you're dealing with a subject, when you're dealing with the Bible, you're going to come across a lot of people who take it very seriously.
Absolutely.
I'm surprised you haven't gotten more oomph back.
Well, perhaps it hasn't fallen into the right conservative hands yet, but... Max and I both went, he's Disciples of Christ, but grew up Catholic. I'm Presbyterian and grew up Baptist. So we sort of meet in the middle.
I'm trying to do the geography on that one.
Well, he came from the Catholic end and I came from the Baptist friend, and it's astounding that we were ever friends. And we don't agree on anything except for Jesus, really, pretty much. But and that humor is important. We both think each other is hilarious, so that's how we get along. And I think there's a lot of humor in Scripture. I mean... If we believe that God created all humans and animals, you can look at the platypus and think that God must have had a heck of a sense of humor. The book also tackles not just sayings, but sort of concepts. Like, you're familiar with the little drummer boy at Christmas?
Mm-hmm.
That's not in real scripture. So we put the drummer boy in there. That's and the serenity prayer, that sort of thing.
And I was looking at some of these. Now, Pride Comes Before the Fall, which is actually kind of an edited version of a real Bible verse.
It is. That concept would be in Scripture, but the actual verse wouldn't. So we have it sort of adapted in there.
God moves in mysterious ways.
Oh, yes. That's in verse 5, chapter 5, verse 5. There's quite a bit of Shakespeare that made it in, like, "Oh, Lord, what fools these mortals be." That sounds real Bible-y, doesn't it?
It does. That does.
That's because Shakespeare, King James, the same era. So
cleanliness next to godliness.
Oh, sure.
Money is the root of all evil.
That too.
That too. Okay. Blessed and highly favored.
Yes. How do you know that was in here? I expect that hard copy of the book is about to be released on Amazon in a couple days. I expect when that's released that we may get a little more blowback, like you said. There may be people that are offended that we tried to add to Scripture, but it's really not that. We really do take our faith very seriously, and just trying to have a little lighthearted fun.
I think this visit from Pope Francis shows that some people in very, very old religious organizations can bring fresh life and maybe a little smile to it.
Well, I appreciate being compared to the Pope, and that should happen all the time, but yes, I agree. The Pope has shown a light in different areas where it hasn't been.
So what else? What didn't I ask you want everyone else to know about this book?
Just don't take it too seriously. It was fun. It was seminarians having fun over a summer break, and also when your children ask you if certain things are in the Bible, you can now quote Hezekiah and say, "Yes, practice what you preach." That is in chapter 2, verse 1. And you can sound authoritative now. keep that Bible close at hand.
I never heard the term Bible nerd before, but now now I can understand how a Bible nerd, quote unquote, would just get off on this.
Well, we had to strike while the iron is hot, chapter 2, verse 3.
Nicely done.
And it's never too late to learn, verse 5.
So. Okay. Well, cool. Well, what's next? Is there any other kings that deserve a Bible book?
There are plenty of people telling us what we've left out. So there could be a second Hezekiah, and I'm not sure. Max and I would have to find one other thing we agree on, and I don't know if that's going to happen, but it'll be funny, whatever it is.
Again, the name of Susan Presley and Harry Hazel's book is Hezekiah, Buried in the Bowels of the Earth for Centuries, recently unearthed by a team of hardy explorers. It's available on Amazon. Still not convinced that people who study the Bible are wacky funsters? Then let's talk about three Atlanta men who met at a Bible study class and have been testing beer recipes on friends at Monday night tasting sessions for the past few years. They ended up starting what was then only the fifth microbrewery in the state of Georgia, and it's still going strong. Gene Bonner reports.
It's a Monday night in April, and Jonathan Baker is standing over a steel keg stirring grain for the India Pale Ale he's brewing that night. Occasionally, he pours out some of the unfermented beer mixture to test.
We're rinsing our milled grain in this stainless steel mash tun here. And we're bringing it up to boil here in the brew kettle.
Baker, who works in marketing, started Monday Night Brewing with two friends from his church. One of the friends is Jeff Heck, who says at first they brewed beer just for fun.
We decided, hey, well, why don't we just brew a batch of beer together? We'll just hang out and get to know each other and have a few beers. And so we did it once, and then it was a blast, and we did it the next week. And then the week after that, some neighbors came by, and the week after that, some coworkers came over. And before we knew it, we were doing it on a pretty regular basis, and we were making better and better beer.
Once they decided to open a brewery, they set a target of 2010 to start brewing commercially.
A big part of starting a brewery is having a distributor.
Distribution has been the death knell for other Atlanta brewers that have come and gone. In Georgia, brewers sell beer through exclusive distributors, and it's not so easy to get their attention. So says Dave Gunder of Sweetwater Brewing Company, a successful Atlanta microbrewery that now distributes in six states.
In a smaller brewery or an upstart brewery, you know, they may be in a position where, you know, they're a little bit humble and would have to ask, or in some cases, plead a distributor to carry their product just because they're not a proven entity yet.
The Monday Night Brewing team is trying to learn from other brewers' mistakes. For example, they won't build a brewery right away, Heck says.
Typically, a distributor wants you to have sufficient volume up front to meet the demand, but you don't necessarily know how much it's going to be or what kind of capacity you need to have. So what we're doing is we're actually going to have a third-party brewer, another brewer, who has a brewery, brew our beer for us. It's called Contract Brewing.
The contract brewer is Thomas Creek Brewery of Greenville, South Carolina. The arrangement will make their startup costs lower. The group has raised money from friends, family, and some investors. Demand for microbrewed beer has continued to grow despite the recession. Joel Iverson, the group's third partner, thinks Monday Night Brewing can help fill a hole in the Georgia beer market.
When you look at so many other states, when you look at Colorado, California, so many other states, there's sort of this plethora of microbrewed beer, and here we're sort of stuck with very minimal local flair.
On that Monday night in April, regulars mixed with first-timers who read a blog the trio keeps about brewing. One attendee, Mark Hermes, is a home brewer.
I'd read their blog for the longest time before I actually came. I said, okay, these guys got an awesome premise going on here, so let me go check it out, and I hope their beer backs it up, and it does, so that's really cool.
In addition to the IPA, Monday Night Brewing will offer a Scotch Ale. I'm Gene Bonner.
Still to come, some students in the current wave of migrants in Europe are facing barriers to completing their education. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Many migrants want to complete or even start their education when they arrive at their destination. For over 500,000 refugees this year, that destination is Germany. According to UN figures, almost 30% of those refugees have some education but need a few more years to complete their studies. But that's more difficult than you might expect. When they arrive, many of the refugees' hopes are dashed as it can take a long time to become fully registered or even be granted refugee or asylum status. One young man, Marcus Kressler, is trying to change all that with the Wings University. DW Radio correspondent Victoria Klebervet traveled to meet him in Berlin. Her report is voiced here in English by Kate Laycock.
Marcus Kressler and three of his friends, Mohammed, Nora and Basha, are sitting in front of a little fast food restaurant in Berlin-Mitte on a wooden bench. They've ordered pizza. A lot of Marcus's friends fled war zones like Syria and Afghanistan. After he got to know them 2 years ago through participating in a protest camp for refugees, he became more and more angry with how refugees were being treated in Germany.
Most of them just had 1 year to go to finish their degree in medicine or engineering. Their journey to Germany often took them 3 years. And then they'd be subjected to another 18-month wait for their asylum status to be assessed. I saw that as wasted talent. It's extremely bad for your psyche, too.
Bureaucratic hurdles are tough in Germany. The asylum status has to be clarified, and college degrees from their home countries have to be validated. All of that can take up to 5 years. That's way too long, says Marcus, and so he decided to take action himself and founded a university just for refugees called the Wings University.
At Wings University, we are trying to remove obstacles. The biggest obstacle is money. So studying at Wings University is for free. But there are other obstacles, like previous certificates that are missing. So at our university, you don't need a previous certificate. You can study without them.
In a little office in the center of Berlin, Marcus is preparing the launch of Wings University for the autumn. The walls are covered in post-it notes in yellow, green, pink and blue, and he's surrounded by a team of young volunteers, most of them students, who are all eager to help realize his idea. Currently, they're working on arranging schedules with professors who will teach the classes in the autumn. Lectures will be held by professors from world-leading universities such as Harvard and Stanford, and they're contributing their time for free. Wings University is only an online university, so classes will be posted online and will be accessible to anyone who wants to download them. Initially, Wings University will start with three bachelor and master courses: engineering, business development and computer science. These were selected for a good reason, says Marcus.
We conducted a survey with almost 1,000 refugees, and the result was these are the three main fields of interest, with which we can cover 50% of what refugees would like to study.
Nidal Abbas is one of the refugees who participated in the survey. The 19-year-old was enrolled at a local university in his home country of Syria, but then the war started.
I was studying architecture engineering and preparing myself to great future. And then everything destroyed.
Nidal had to flee the violence in Syria and came to Germany, where he's now living by himself. Like Nidal, almost 30% of the refugees currently living in Germany already have college qualifications and want to continue their education. Once the Wings University is up and running, a partner university will take control of the examinations. Currently, Marcus Kressler and his team are in contact with several interested universities in and outside Germany. The overreaching question is how to finance Wings University in the long term.
At the moment, we are all working on a voluntary basis. We're hoping to get some private donations and scholarships from foundations so that we can cover our finances in the short run. But in the long term, we'll receive subsidies from the German government for each enrolled student.
Wings University has already received its first donations. Markus and his team are planning to start a crowdfunding campaign to get more donations in the future. Nidal and many other refugees are hoping that they can benefit from this support. For them, attending university is about more than just earning a degree. It's the key to a financially stable life.
I couldn't just achieve to here to Germany, arrive to here without the family support. And I have to back this support for them. I have three little sisters. I have to take care of them.
Nidal is constantly in communication with Markus and the Wings University team. Everyone involved is driven by a common goal: to enable refugees who wish to participate and contribute to society to realise their potential. It's already been a huge amount of work, and Markus knows that he has lots more in front of him. What motivates him is the support of everyone who hears about his idea.
We are receiving emails on a daily basis from the whole world, from refugee organizations, from established Berlin universities that have some cool projects running for refugees. And all of them want to enable refugees to finish their degree and to send them to our university in order to do that.
That's DW Radio correspondent Victoria Klebervet. Her report is voiced here in English by Kate Laycock. The migrant situation in Europe is one thing in the news today. Another is Planned Parenthood. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Planned Parenthood and abortion are often linked in the news. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Robin Rosen, a professor of history and women's studies at Marist College, talks about the complex history the organization has with abortion.
Planned Parenthood clinics are being closed all over the country. This organization's status as a poster child for the culture wars began in the 1980s and has been fixed firmly ever since. But generations of controversy tends to obscure the organization's history. Established in 1921 as the American Birth Control League, it fought for the legalization and accessibility of contraception. Attaining these goals necessitated avoiding any discussion of women's sexual freedom in favor of arguments that emphasized maternal and infant health. Over the next decades, advocates touted the eugenic benefits of birth control, as well as its role in population control and the amelioration of poverty. These varied arguments ultimately worked, and by the early 70s, the family planning movement had become rather mainstream, even making it on an 8-cent postage stamp in 1972. All of this changed the very next year when the Supreme Court legalized abortion in the Roe v. Wade decision. On the heels of this decision, the historical record shows that Planned Parenthood clinics around the country faced a dilemma. Should they add abortion to their family planning service? While some argued that abortion constituted a natural next step for an organization devoted to helping women manage their reproductive health, others recognized that in an increasingly polarized political and cultural climate, opposition to the work of Planned Parenthood would develop if it took on this responsibility. So, while the women's movement of the 60s and 70s campaigned vigorously for abortion rights, making it a central issue for feminists, the family planning movement did not take on a leadership role in this cause. My research shows that there was a certain level of discomfort in the feminist cry for the right of women to control their bodies, as Planned Parenthood had consciously distanced itself from feminist rhetoric for so many decades. Thus, our current association of Planned Parenthood with abortion belies the complexity of this organization's history.
That was Robin Rosen of Marist College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.